What do I do to maximize the probability that this time this project succeeds, right? And there were many things. I was like, it's time to get serious and stop playing around on all these little projects. Hello, and welcome to the inaugural episode of the Braid Anniversary Edition podcast. Braid Anniversary is an updated version of the classic game Braid that came out way back in 2008. And the remaster has improved graphics and sound and new puzzles. But in addition to that, it's got a bunch of very deep developer commentary. Over 15 hours of commentary survived the editing process, but this came from over 60 hours of initially recorded audio. Thus, this podcast. As these episodes proceed, we'll have different people doing the interviews, and our first interviewer is Casey Muratori, who many people may know from his computer-enhanced Substack, where he teaches programming, and from his popular YouTube series, Handmade Hero. If you don't know Casey, you'll get to know him by listening to what he has to say in the interview, so let's get to it.
So, I guess I don't really know, but I know you've said that you got the idea for Braid in late 2004.
Yeah. Well, and it was your idea, actually.
And I've always been a little confused by that, but I mean, I guess I sort of know what you mean. But so why don't you walk us through exactly what that means? Because obviously there's the email that I wrote that I think you're referring to.
Yeah.
But I think there's a deeper through line there, because that part is just one piece of it. There's the whole thing with, like, invisible cities. And, there's all these other lineages that are, like, involved there, and I don't really know in what order these start gelling together. It's obviously not just like, oh, there's this one email, and everything happened after the email. There was, like, a bunch of things, I feel like, so.
Yes. It's a little – there are many factors that it's hard to place, but – before the email, mm-hmm. sort of the background that was percolating mm-hmm. was Invisible Cities was one of my favorite books. Mm-hmm. And there were other works at the time that were obviously influenced by that. Right. Mm-hmm. And one of these was a book called Einstein's Dreams mm-hmm. By someone who is a physicist in his day job, Alan Lightman. Right. Mm-hmm. And so both of these books take the form of a bunch of little vignettes that mm-hmm. are three or four pages each that mm-hmm. explore some different idea that is a little bit absurdist or mm-hmm. somehow obviously not the case.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
Like not literal explorations and not logical explorations. So in Invisible Cities, you know, there are cities where I'm not going to remember any of them well enough to like do justice, but you know, there's a city where every point above, it's like on the water, right? Like Venice. And every point of the city above the water has a corresponding point below.
Okay.
But it's also conflated with the reflection in the water. And like people are spying on each other and there are no secrets because from every point of the city, you can see every other point by looking in the reflection. I'm completely butchering it, but it's things like that. It's things that like don't exactly map to reality 100%.
Right.
Right. The one that my company is named after, which of course I remember the best.
Okay.
It's a city built by just looking up at the stars and seeing what the structure and the architecture is and like, okay, let's copy that down here. And it always seems to be perpetually under construction and never completed. Right?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is maybe a little bit of a bad omen when you...
That's great.
Yeah.
But appropriate for a game development...
Sadly.
...life cycle, yeah.
Sadly. And then Einstein's Dreams was like that, but different. It was, you know, many people know the story that Albert Einstein was a lowly, not particularly respected patent clerk before he did all his good stuff. And Einstein's Dreams is about him going home every day after the office and doing his physics at home and like just falling asleep, thinking about what is the answer to how it could be that light behaves.
Right.
Right. And You know, so on the one hand, this is like maybe there are different topologies to the universe. If there's right. a fourth dimension, what is it and how it behaves?
Yeah.
But it's also used to, it's like transposed onto, let's say, the idea dimension of like what people are and how they behave and like how their relationships go and stuff, right?
Right.
And so in a certain kind of universe, maybe light goes kind of slow and that makes everything cold and people are cold to each other or something. Again, I'm butchering it.
Okay. Right? Okay.
But like that's the basic idea. And
so it's sort of like it's like a very it's like a very like microcosmic thing where all the different parts are exhibiting the same sorts of like of change. So we make one change, but we kind of pretend that change ripples through everything, even if it wouldn't necessarily make quite logical physical sense that that was true.
Yeah. Sometimes it varies a little bit.
Okay.
What I would say is that there's a constant use of laws of physics in an analogical way, like to make analogies with like ways that behavior could be. And,
gotcha.
And sometimes that's more literal and sometimes it's less literal.
I
right?
see.
Now that even, it's very clear to me now, and maybe it even was then, but that actually owes a lot to another set of Calvino stories called the Cosmic Comic Stories.
Okay.
Which is very explicitly about that too. It's like there's different. So one of the early Cosmic Comic Stories is like there's a guy who's just like rotating in space around, like he's in a certain part of the galaxy and his life is just many rotations of the galaxy.
Okay.
And he's very alone. And once in a while he passes maybe a mark that somebody else made and he wonders like what is this and who made it and
okay.
where did it come from and
all right.
that kind of a thing. Or another one is it's at many different scales. So another one of the stories is you could imagine the moon being much closer to the Earth and with mm-hmm. a more eccentric orbit such that sometimes it comes a lot closer and sometimes it's further
mm-hmm.
and gravity is a little bit different so that like maybe the ground kind of melts up like cheese a little bit. And
okay.
on there's like an expedition where it comes so close at a certain time that like we're going to cross and we're going to go to the
wow.
moon by like throwing ropes up there and like
yeah.
climbing up there. Right. It's that kind of story. And they're very entertaining. And I recommend them to anyone who's interested because they're all very readable because the stories are often very short and they have an enjoyable idea that they get to very quickly. And actually, in the U.S., there's like two different, you know, things get published
yeah.
and cut up in different ways. In the
yeah.
U.S., originally, as I read them, there was a collection called Cosmic Comics and then a sequel collection called T-Zero, right?
Okay.
And then later, I think I also have a volume called The Complete Cosmic Comics that contains both of those and then a couple more stories.
Okay.
But all of this, you know, I had read as much Calvino as I could get my hands on. And all of that was influential on what Braid was, although don't blame him if you don't like the text in the game because it's very different from anything he would have written, right?
Okay,
like,
okay.
Part of what I was consciously doing is like not copying, right? Like let's make this its own thing, even though it's heavily influenced. But so all that was flying around sort of in my mind at some point. Like I wanted to do a game version of what I liked about these stories, right?
And what's the earliest you remember thinking about that? I mean, how far back are we talking?
I don't really know.
Possibly
a year before I actually did Braid, but it would have been a very vague idea.
So it wasn't like the first time you read Calvino, you were just thinking it would be cool to make a game like this sometime.
No, not
it
at
was,
all.
It was actually much closer to the actual time of making Braid that you first started thinking like, hey—
Yeah,
it would be neat to do something like that. Those books that I read.
Yeah, and specifically what I was thinking was, well, you know, in a story, you can just sort of postulate whatever the laws of physics are. Like, okay, the moon comes really close and it pulls the ground up and stuff, right? Doesn't exactly work that way in a game, especially like the more systemic the game is, the more you kind of can't just cheat that sort of thing. You have to more make a system that exhibits those properties.
Right.
And that to me is more magical.
Right.
Right. I was like, there's something cool. And if it's hard, it seems very hard, but if you can do it, it's a little bit more groundbreaking than just doing a story about the thing. Right.
Right. Yeah.
In the field of games, it's a thing that very few people had done. Now, there were other games that did analogies of this sort, right? Okay. So one of the earliest ones was Rod Humble's game, The Marriage, mm-hmm. Which I had shown at EGW.
Right.
Like, there's two people in this relationship, and they're just colored squares on the screen.
Right,
and you move them around, and some stuff happens. And, you know, and then Jason Rohrer actually had done these two games, Passage and Gravitation. I think both of which predate Braid substantially, if I remember correctly. Although maybe, I might have to look that up. I'm not sure how much they predate it by, but let's just say they also engage in this kind of analogy where there's a system of rules, and those rules are expressive about the situation that the game's about, right?
Right.
It's not just the plot and the fiction that the game is about, but the rules of the universe that are being set up are expressive of what the game is about. And so I wanted to do something like that. And I wanted to do it about physics because, you know, quantum mechanics, for example, is pretty weird, as is relativity, right? And I thought it would be fun to take that weirdness and instead of, you know, conflating it with human scale things in a fiction kind of way, like those stories do, let's conflate it with human level things by just making the phenomena happen on a human scale.
Right.
And then just like seeing what happens and seeing how to make a game out of that. And that'll be fun and interesting. Like, you know, if there's quantum superposition or something and something's at multiple places until the waveform gets localized, that's one idea, right? Mm-hmm. Or one thing that comes up in physics a lot is time being bidirectional, right? Mm-hmm. So, which is even true back in Newtonian physics, but also in relativity and stuff. And so what does that mean? How do you make a game where time is bidirectional? It's challenging because it seems like almost you can't make anything happen.
Right.
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 Because it would have to be a completely pre-recorded sequence for you to go forward and backward. And so what does that mean? And so those questions were just in the air.
I see. And they're kicking around in your head, growing over time, somewhere in the 2003, 2004 kind
of. Yeah, it may not have even been that. It may have been just the few months before.
So like 2004-ish times then. Yeah.
But you can see like how these are very, they're both difficult questions to answer.
Yes.
And also not very actionable until you have a good answer.
Right. Yeah. You're not really going to be able to do much until you get something to hold on to.
Yeah. But then, so there's this mailing list conversation that happens. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's on Game Tech or Game Rants or it was one of the lists that Chris ran.
It was. It was the game design one. So it would have been Game Rants. Is that
probably
what that was called?
Yeah. Yeah. And so my recollection of this was there was some discussion that probably started with Prince of Persia: Sands of Time had come out or something.
Yes.
And so you guys were talking about rewind in games. And I, to my recollection, maybe I contributed to this conversation a little bit, but I was not really one of the people with the strongest opinions in it. But there was a lot of conversation about like, did this game do a good job? And then what does rewind ability mean for games going forward, right? And what I remember you saying was, well, this should just be, this is obviously a technological feature like rewind was for VCRs.
Yeah.
So it should just be in most or all games as something that you can just do,
right?
And then other people objected to that. I think I remember some of who they were, but I won't dox them in case it's wrong. But it's like other people were like, well, you can't do that because you're removing consequence from games, right?
Yes.
And consequence is important and like the all this. And the conversation kind of went back and forth on that for a bit, but I was like, you know, nobody really implemented anything, right?
Right.
And so then I was on vacation and I was thinking about this physics thing, or maybe I think a little bit before the vacation, I was like, you know what? Being able to rewind maps onto this bidirectional time thing that I was thinking about. It's sort of the same idea from a different perspective.
Right.
And so I kind of been wanting to make this Calvino Lightman inspired game. So I started to have an idea like, okay, this is actionable. If I actually program rewind, then it's both contributing to that discussion
because
with an implementation, but also answering this question of like, what can I do about this physics game that's actionable? Now, even at that time, I didn't think the whole game would be rewind. It was just like, right, here's some manifestation of one of the lines of the game. And I did, because Invisible Cities is many different cities and whatnot, right, I was thinking it would be a lot of different worlds.
Right.
And one of them would be the rewind world. Right. But like another one was like the quantum superposition world or something.
Gotcha.
Right?
Yes.
And then there's one more thing playing into all of this, which is, you know, another way to phrase the thing that you were saying is like, look, this is really fundamental. It should just be there. It shouldn't be like a weird game design gimmick. Like for people who don't know Prince of Persia, Sands of Time, which I'm sure right, most people these days don't.
It was not really even that popular at the time. It was all right.
It was a medium level popular game. It had sand that you would use to rewind time, and you had a certain number of charges. And when you ran out of rewind charges, which you could pick up on the map, then you start losing lives when you die, right?
And also, for people whose main like touch point for this is playing Braid, when we say rewind, we don't really mean Braid rewind. It was like a really crappy like 10 seconds of rewind tops or something.
Like, and it was not a technically good, like the sound didn't go backwards.
And the animations were all screwed up.
Yeah.
And it was very limited. So you could not like rewind all the way back to to the beginning of a long level or anything like that.
No. It was like they had some ring buffer with character positions in it.
Yeah.
And then they made the rest up or something.
Yeah. It was not really the kind of gameplay thing that it is in Braid, where it's expected to always work and always go all the way back and all that stuff.
Yeah. Now, there was one other ingredient that your position on that argument reminded me of, which was I had been in person earlier at Brian Moriarty's lecture at the GDC, The Secret of Psalm 46, which is one of his more famous lectures. Mm-hmm. And if you're curious about that, it exists in its entirety in The Witness, which you can, although it's hard to get to. But if you get to it, you get to listen to the whole thing.
Yes.
You can also read the transcript online. I don't know if the audio is online. Anyway.
If you're serious about it, you will beat the entire Witness and find the audio. I'm going to watch it there.
Yes.
If you just
lazy, if you're a gamer,
you can go read it online.
Yeah. So one of the things that he was saying in that speech is that, like, things that are powerful, like things that are fundamental are generous, right?
Mm-hmm,
like the,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to paraphrase really badly because it's been a while since I listened to it, but like the world is just generous in a certain, there's like a lot of air for you to breathe. And there's like a lot of, there's a lot of surprise and a lot of situate, like, and part of what he was expressing in that talk was frustration with sort of the limited thinking of game developers, right? And the way that I make you care about stuff is artificial scarcity, right? Which is weird, though, because he's also talking a lot about this masquerade thing, which sort of is artificial scarcity. There's something in that talk that I never fully resolved for myself about exactly what side he was on, right? But the point being, like he has some line where he's like, and this isn't the exact phrase, but he says something like, profound things are generous. The magic is right there.
Yes.
If what people want is invincibility, just give it to them, right? And he said that a couple years at least before this conversation happened, right?
Yes.
I really liked that speech, and that had been floating around in my head also. Like, as a, again, I didn't know how to action that. I mean, obviously you could make a platformer where the character is invincible, but like, okay, how, why is that good?
Right.
And so those were all the seeds of this thing, and they came together at this time. And I was, I think that before the vacation, I had enough of the idea that I might want to do this that I, you know, I had all this code laying around from previous projects, and I think I did the thing where you strip it down to like the minimal running executable that still has all my usual game code.
Right.
So it's got like the vectors and the whatever.
And
it opens Windows
and
it does some sound, but like, and it loads bitmaps, but like there's no game there, right?
Yes.
I think I prepped that before the vacation. And I was like, maybe I'll work on it, maybe not, I don't know. And then during the vacation, I ended up working on it for like a whole week.
And where was this vacation too?
It was in Thailand, mostly around Chiang Mai, which is the capital, but then some other places nearby.
Mm-hmm. So you go on this vacation thinking maybe I'll work on this. But one of the interesting things I didn't hear, that was actually a very coherent series of like ideas coming together. So it's like very understandable sort of how that worked out.
Yeah.
But what I didn't hear is why is it like a 2D platformer from like, because, you know, there are many things you could have done. You could have done something more like a top down sort of thing, or you yeah. could have decided it should have been in 3D, or you could have. So there was something that made you pick that. Was that just, hey, a random first guess and then it stuck? Or were you like, there's a reason?
There are two reasons, two lines of reasoning that came together. One was, hey, when I first went into games industry, didn't even feel like the industry at the time, but doing this bolt action stuff, we did some really hard, challenging thing, and we only had two programmers. Like, imagine anyone, by the way, again, to bring this up again, imagine anyone in the year 2022 saying, I've got a two-person programming team. We're going to build our own game engine that doesn't even use the graphics API. And we're, it's going to be drop in, drop out, client server, narrow bandwidth action game. Yeah. And we're going to make it in like a year or 2 years. Yeah. It's like nobody these days would even try that. And like we somehow did it without even being in games.
Right, right.
I would like to make the point, and this is off what we're talking about a little bit, but it's important, I think. The culture back then was even importantly different than it is today.
Okay.
In the way that information was shared, right?
Right.
So we mentioned our Korea talk that we went and did. And even before that, like when Mike Abrash would go give a speech, I think even Carmack gave a speech 1 year at GDC. He didn't do that very often.
I do think he did do it 1 year, yes. It was extremely rare. And that's one of the things Mike Abrash did while he was at it is actually like share the information.
Yeah.
Not because Carmack didn't want it shared, but because he just never took the time.
Yeah. But we said this a little bit about how he published the secrets of the six cycle texture mapper that was an incredible piece of technology, right?
Yeah.
But there was a conscientious decision back then, I think, that we all decided to cooperate and just share everything we figured out and not really have trade secrets. And that is very different from how some other cultures decided to approach it. So, for example, in Japan, which was also had its own relatively separate video game culture.
Very separate at the time.
They were much more about trade secrets and competing with each other, right?
Really?
Every encounter that I had, it seemed that way.
Interesting. I don't know.
Yeah. And I do think there was a time, like, you know, if you think about the Nintendo days or whatever, Japan was dominating games.
Yeah.
And then I think as things went 3D and got complicated, I think America won for a while.
Yeah.
And I think it was mainly because we were sharing information openly with each other and solving these problems at a very fast clip.
It could be.
We don't really do that anymore. And again,
what do you mean?
I mean, well, not in the same way. Like there are definitely people on the internet who are very open.
Yeah.
But like Doom back in the day was like the biggest game.
Yes.
Everybody wanted to know how Doom works, and then they just told you.
Yes.
And then later they released the source, because why not, right? Yeah. What are some of the biggest games today? I don't know. Grand Theft Auto Online.
Right.
Those guys ain't telling you nothing about how that works, right? Now, that said, there's nothing that's that technically challenging about it relative to other games, I don't think. But if there were, they would not tell you, right?
Okay.
Like Apex Legends, right? Whatever. Like most of these games, you don't hear much about them, right?
Is that really true? I mean, I guess I don't know, but like, I'm just thinking, you know, there at least maybe it stopped at some point, but at least at some point there was just, you know, hey, here's the Frostbite team published 10 PDFs.
There is of some like, of that.
Here's how we do the things, but it's just like, there's not much to say because these things are so huge that what the secret of how you ship Battlefield, you know, 1 is just that somehow we frickin' shipped Battlefield 1. There wasn't like, oh, here's how the texture matters. No one cares.
Yeah. Well, I think that is a second part of it, which is very true, which is like not everybody has the same problem anymore. Or the problem is not even that definable. But it's true, as you say, I don't mean to say that nobody does this, but there are some people who do a lot of it and other people the majority of the industry who really does none of it. And then the third thing that happened is...
You're very correct about Rockstar separately, by the way. Rockstar in particular is notorious for never talking about anything they do.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the third thing that happened is, of course, the internet's gotten much bigger and more occupied and game development is more democratized and all these things. And so there sure are a lot of people who want to tell you how to make games on the internet, but
yes,
most of them have not really made games themselves of any
right.
note or at all, right?
Yeah.
And so there's like a noise floor that's been coming up
right.
the
yes.
whole time. And it just all makes for a very different environment than we had in those days.
Yes.
Anyway, so... why was I on that topic?
I'm not sure, because my question was, why is the game 2D? It sounds like that was part of the answer.
That was part of the answer.
Why,
a little bit.
Why it was trying to be simple.
Okay.
So I get getting 3D out of the mix. But now there are many different types of 2D games. There's top down, there's isometric, there's...
Yeah, let me go back platform. To that for
okay.
a second, right? Because so like I said, I'd had a hard time firstly with Bolt Action, but we made a game. We
yes.
made several iterations of it. It shipped to people.
Yes.
It was grueling, but we did it. And we
yes.
were poor all the time and all
yes.
that. After that, like I said, I was kind of burned out. I worked on other projects like Gallstaff, and there was probably other 3D stuff before Gallstaff. And like everything I did was trying to be 3D in some way. You know, the air guitar game was trying to parse 3D space,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Like that's even harder.
Yeah.
I definitely noticed the pattern. And you know, so Happy Cake, for example, as we discussed, was completed.
Also
and
3D.
3D. It was a lot of work. We got it done. But also the delta between that and a game that I would have liked was like still pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I had a good taste for how hard 3D was. I knew that I could do it, but I also knew that it was going to take a lot of time and energy to do it, both technically, firstly,
mm-hmm.
but also in terms of design. Just
mm-hmm.
getting things to feel good in 3D is harder.
Yeah.
Solving issues like, oh, there's just visibility problems here, or collision doesn't feel good, or whatever
right.
it is. Those are all easier just from a design standpoint in 2D than 3D.
I see.
Right. And so what I was saying to myself was, you know, I would have envisioned that I would have done a big, groundbreaking, meaningful game. I was about to say important, but I don't know what important means. And I don't think I would have said it that way. But
okay.
like, I wanted to really make my contribution to games. And I hadn't made a game that was like that yet.
Okay.
Right. Even so Happy Cake didn't ship to anybody. The Bolt Action game was played by a 3 or 4 digit number of people.
Right.
You know, and then didn't continue after that.
Right.
So it's like, when am I going to do this thing? And what do I do to maximize the probability that this time this project succeeds, right? And there were many things. I was like, it's time to get serious and stop
okay.
playing around on all these little projects. Now, we've talked through a lot of the consulting that I did. We talked through a few of the projects that I did, but like there were a lot of little projects. And when we skimmed over like Game Developer Magazine, right?
Right.
I did that for like 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like 20 to 30 little projects.
Yeah, yeah.
That whole thing.
Yeah.
It was nuts.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, let's stop messing around and make a game that's really good. So firstly, eliminate technical challenge and design challenge by being 2D.
Right.
Okay, what kind of 2D? There's lots of 2D games.
This is sort of the... the bullseye of the question, which is I wasn't quite sure how you ended up with.
Well, I already knew like, okay, we're going to screw around with time.
Okay.
Right. At least. And maybe we're going to do this other quantum stuff. It's unclear. But what is the form of it? Well, we know from the Calvino influence, it's about going between different worlds
mm-hmm.
and the rules change in every world.
Right.
And that's what's cool about it. Like
okay.
maybe in this world, there's superposition. Right.
Right.
Maybe in this world, there's time goes backwards, whatever.
Right.
But it's interesting that you part of the entertainment value or the knowledge you take from the game is
right.
seeing and understanding those changes. Right. How do you do that? Well, somehow you're comparing them with the baseline. If you don't have the ability to compare them like, hey,
right.
we've got this cool superposition thing. how do you understand why the superposition is interesting and how it's cool and how it affects things? Well, you know how the things would have been without the superposition, and then you add the superposition, right? And so I was thinking, hey, the value in this game is supposed to come from the cool reality bendy stuff. If the rules of the game are really complicated, and then you apply some reality bendy stuff, you might not even know, like, how some interaction would have resulted in the vanilla one,
right,
if it's complicated. And then you're going to be uncertain and unclear. And then especially if it's a puzzle game, which I was pretty sure it was going to be.
Okay.
If it's unclear what is the local reality weirdness effect and what is the base rule set, that's a level of uncertainty that you don't want on the ground level when, like, trying to solve puzzles, right? That's going to mess up the puzzle solving. And so I knew all this without having designed the game at all, which just, I think, tells you that I'd been thinking about this kind of thing for years in the EGW and elsewhere, right?
Right. Okay.
So what are the simple kinds of games? I just thought through them, and a Mario game came to mind very quickly, right? Whereas some games in that genre have, like, a lot of creatures and a lot of characters with different abilities and all this stuff.
Right.
Very clearly, the prototypical Mario game is there's one monster that just goes in a straight line and you could jump on his head.
Right.
Like, that's the minimum for the that genre.
Right.
And then you could dial that up. Like, you could add more monsters if you want them, if you need more complexity. And so I could figure out later what is the weird stuff and then gauge based on that how much more can the game sustain.
Right.
And I knew all this before literally typing any code.
Okay.
Yeah.
So basically the selection of Mario was largely driven by wanting the simplest possible visually understandable mechanic that people would just go, okay, the baseline one is obvious to me, so that when it starts getting modified, they're not like, what the heck happened? They could clearly see, like, oh, right, it's this.
Yeah.
Okay.
And now you can think about some other games that are simple, like Asteroids is simple. Robotron is simple. And it just thinking through those, it's like, well, like, I could, so the Mario game has this element of, like, it's a guy, right?
Yeah.
And that brings it to a human scale. Like, the Mario games, Mario's a character. And that's a little bit like the humanity in the stories that I wanted to, like, wanted to bridge to that. If you have, like, a little arrow-sized spaceship, you're not getting that, right?
Right.
So
was that a concrete thought you had when evaluating these?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I thought through a bunch of them. And in fact, this was probably the genesis of the idea that there were going to be a bunch of retro games in Braid as well of other
genres.
Which
we'll have to talk about, since that did not actually happen.
That did not actually happen.
We should talk about those.
Yeah.
That concludes the first episode of the Braid Anniversary Edition podcast. Thank you for listening. And if you want another episode, come on back next week. Braid Anniversary Edition comes out on May 14th, 2024. You can pre-order it now on Steam, and you can buy it on game consoles pretty soon. In this episode, Casey Muratori asked questions, Jonathan Blow answered questions, Jason Brisson produced, and Will Torbett edited. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.